Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Is it just me, or has TV gotten really complicated? I'm either endlessly searching for my favorite shows or subscribing to a dozen different streaming services to make sure I can watch everything I love. And I'm not even saving that much money compared to my old cable bill. Thankfully, Philo has changed all that for me. One service, all the stuff I need. Philo's got current seasons of the shows I can't miss live on networks like Paramount, A&E, MTV, Discovery, and TLC. Classics like The Office, Martin, and Friends that I never get sick of, and all of the incredible originals on AMC Plus, from Mad Men to Orphan Black. Don't forget their library of more than 75,000 movies and shows, all of which I can save and re-watch anytime for a whole year. Never miss a minute of shows like Gypsy Rose, Life After Lockup on Lifetime, Yellowstone, or Fatal Attraction. Best of all, with Philo, you get all this for just $28 a month. No contracts, no hassles. Just one subscription and a world of entertainment. So go to philo.tv and check it out for a free 7-day trial. That's philo.tv to start watching.
Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We talk about the economy, both world here, domestically, state and otherwise, and he joins us at noon every Monday. We appreciate that. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So, Guy, I wanted to touch on this topic because over the weekend I was reading all kinds of things about EVs, the whole market. It is topsy-turvy. It's getting worse, and the Chinese are getting stronger. Layoffs, bankruptcies. I'm not sure if this is a tailspin that we actually come out of. Your thoughts?
Well, we're making a mistake, and we're creating a problem for U.S. automakers. And the mistake is we're protecting U.S. automakers from competition. And the problem with that is Chinese electric vehicle manufacturers have created some pretty effective electric vehicles. Now, we invented this business back in the days of Henry Ford. The first electrical cars were made in the U.S. And in the beginning, there was competition between steam-powered, electric, and then, of course, gasoline-powered, and no one really knew which one would win. But, Edison thought it would be electric. Well, it turned out to be gasoline-powered. But this is a technology we pioneered. Tesla was the first mass-market, really profitable electric car. But now we're in an awkward situation. China is producing lots and lots of electric vehicles, relatively inexpensive, and rather than force our companies to compete, we're putting severe tariffs on them. Now, the challenge with that is, okay, they won't sell those cars in America, but what's going to happen is China is going to produce very cheap EVs, sell them to their customers, sell them in Asia, sell them in Africa, sell them in South America, and they'll create more and more efficiencies of scale, and we will, in the meantime, have this protected garden where we're not competing with the most efficient producers. And in the long run, that means we're not going to be able to maintain a position in the electric vehicle industry. And it really is unfortunate. We've got a lot of government policies that subsidize this and that. And it's really better to let the market dictate the winners and losers, because the government has a hard time picking who's the best company. And we see that with the bankruptcy of the big battery company in Sweden over the weekend.
Yeah, Northvolt, that's what kind of stimulated me to have this conversation. They were held out to be, you know, one of Europe's last hopes of being able to challenge the Chinese and the manufacture of batteries. And they filed for bankruptcy. They have 1 week's worth of expenses in cash available to them. They just closed a number of loans. The CEO is gone, has resigned. And there's a lot of nervousness now. Volkswagen laying off 4,000 people in Europe. European demand's down. There's concern about where Donald Trump's going to be on the $7,500 rebate for EV vehicles here. U.S. auto manufacturers are now asking for that extension to go on or to extend that because they need to wind down and they're not going to have the money to do so on the EV side because there's literally no demand.
Yeah, well, no demand might be an exaggeration, but there's nowhere near the demand they projected. And that's the problem. Ford cut back, you know, their pickup truck was going to be the savior, and it is just extremely expensive. And the problem that Ford has identified is there's a limited number of people that want to pay $100,000 for a fully electric, you know, all tricked out electric pickup. And they pretty much have sold pickups to all of those folks. So now the challenge is, well, what do you do next? And what we have to do next is become globally competitive again. And you don't do it by protecting U.S. manufacturers. And look, I understand the auto companies, if the government were giving us in the banking industry a subsidy per customer, you know, we'd want to maintain it too. But it would be better to subsidize nothing and let competition dictate what wins. You know, there was another comment over the weekend from Toyota, and it was a little bit of an I told you so. Toyota said, we were criticized for not focusing exclusively on EVs, but our position was we would let the market dictate the cars that they wanted to buy. So we produce hybrids, fully electric, and also hydrogen-powered vehicles, and we're open to other green alternatives. You know, we have a tremendous commitment to lowering carbon emissions, but we don't want to get in front of our customers. And I thought, you know, Toyota actually got it right. You need to let the customers tell you what they want to buy and then, you know, build the car. You know, Toyota has a neat technology that could end up being the winning one. You basically are substituting basically bottles of condensed hydrogen, which runs the car. So it solves the timing problem. You go into the replacement station, you unscrew one, put in a new one, and off you go. And that's one of the challenges. You know, there was an article over the weekend about a charging company that's putting in these little mini charging things, but it's not a fast charger, and the charging stations give you about 20 miles after about 30 minutes of charging. Well, that's not real exciting. That's sort of get-home charging, but that doesn't solve the charging anxiety. So I think we've gotten ahead of what the consumer wants, and that's caused the problem. And you mentioned Volkswagen. Volkswagen has a terrible situation because they've never had layoffs. They've never closed plants in Germany. They have the highest cost of any manufacturer in Europe. And the labor unions are up in arms about the thought of losing jobs, and understandably so. It's a union's job to protect workers. But when demand goes down, you're selling fewer cars, and the cars you're making require fewer workers to manufacture. It's hard to maintain employment.
How long before all of these other manufacturers and all of the other countries other than China end up going to China for their batteries?
Well, it's going to be based upon price. You know, if you can deliver an inexpensive battery, the rest of the world is going to go to that place because, you know, they don't have an indigenous car manufacturer. There's an interesting sidelight in Africa. They're going to electric motorcycles, and basically you charge out the battery. So you're not having to wait for the battery to be charged. You just pull it out and ship it in and drop it in. But these motorcycles are used as taxis. People ride on the back, and It's more cost effective than a gasoline powered motorcycle. So when it becomes cost effective, that's when you get mass adoption. And that's what we're seeing in different places, is when you can do things that make sense, then the consumer is going to follow along.
Because it seems to me, reading between the lines, reading the tea leaves, you would know better than me, but it seems that many of these folks are resigned to the fact that they're going to be buying batteries from China in the very near future. That's what it looks like to me. And if you were, let me ask the question this way, if you are a betting man, you bet on them or against China?
Well, actually, in the long run, I'm betting on us because they have a lot of structural problems. In the short run, we're giving them an advantage. And you know, we forget about some of the things we've done that are self-inflicted. We refuse to give permits to a company to mine battery materials in Arizona. We also, the U.S. government, refused to build a road in Alaska that would access cobalt and other minerals needed to make batteries. So when we hurt ourselves, it's not a surprise that other countries jump in and fill the gap. So in the short run, I think they're going to be a better manufacturer of batteries than we are. But it may well turn out that that hydrogen is the fuel of the future, not electricity, and we go a different way to get to the same green outcome. The good thing is we're incredibly creative here. You know, as I say, we invented the first mass market electric vehicle. If we would step out of the way as government and let the manufacturers compete, I think we'd do just fine. We've got a short-run challenge in batteries for sure, but I think a long-run advantage in competitiveness.
Guy, obviously this is the week of Thanksgiving. It's the week that we should be thankful for a number of things. You say that there are a number of reasons we should be thankful for the U.S. economy. Tell us.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Newell, I think, you know, one of the problems that we faced, and I'm glad the elections are over, but a lot of people wanted to talk about what was wrong. And there's no country in the world that would want to trade places with us economically that wouldn't want to trade places. We have the highest GDP per capita anywhere in the world, and we're growing faster than any of the other industrialized countries. We're also growing faster than China. And I think one of the things that people forget is the Chinese economic statistics are not actually as reliable as ours. So when you look at the best numbers we can get, when you analyze all the variables, we're actually growing faster than China is, and certainly much faster than the European Union. So when you think of what's going on, we've grown in the past 10 years about 73% compared to the European Union at 39%. So we have a much faster economic growth, and our productivity is higher. So our workers generate more productivity per worker than anyone else in the world. And that's something that gives us a tremendous competitive advantage. It's one of the reasons we invent so many things. And we come up with the new technologies, we rapidly develop it, and we put it in place. And that gives us an advantage against the rest of the world.
I know one of the things that you and I have talked about, that, and I know that's probably one of the issues that you think that we should be thankful for, and the incoming administration talks about this a lot, energy independence. A lot of folks a lot of folks don't really understand what that means. What does it mean?
What it means is, I don't want to say we don't have to care about the Middle East. We certainly should care. But we're not reliant on the Middle East for our energy. In fact, we are an exporter of energy. We're the reason that Europe can stay in the fight against Russia and Ukraine. If it weren't for U.S. natural gas exports, Europe would have to fold their hand and take the whatever terms Russia wanted to give them, because they became dependent upon the Europeans became dependent on Russian natural gas. So our energy independence means that we produce all the natural gas, all the oil that we need, and enough to support our allies around the world. And that is a tremendous improvement over the old days when, you know, people talked about the Arab oil embargo and us being held hostage. You know, some of the old timers remember Jimmy Carter in his cardigan sweater talking about malaise and the challenge of dealing with the energy shortage and the 55 mile an hour national speed limit and long gas lines. That doesn't happen in the U.S. We have a great competitive industry. But the other thing that people forget is we also have tremendous resources in terms of green energy. When you look at a map of the U.S., the entire Southwest is a wonderful spot for solar power. The Southeast, particularly down in through Florida, is another great spot for solar energy. So we have lots of space, which the Europeans don't have. That's a densely populated area without a lot of open fields. We have tremendous open areas out west where you can put solar farms. But that's not all. We all sound like a darn Ronco commercial, but wait, there's more. We have wind resources on the east and west coast, and a company called Vestas is actually looking at putting windmills in the lake. I'm talking about Lake Pontchartrain, west of the causeway, where it wouldn't interfere with anything, but it would provide additional green energy to the south and north shore. So we have the ability to do wind power. We have the ability to make the wind power here in New Orleans at Michoud, which is wonderful, the technology to deploy it because of our oil and gas industry. So when you look at wind power, we've got all the ingredients you need, the manufacturing, the delivery capability with our offshore oil vessels, and the sites with great wind power, the Northeast, the Northwest corridors along the Atlantic, and also on the Gulf. And then finally, our nuclear industry is beginning to come back. And you know, we were obviously the first ones to have nuclear power plants. Once again, we invented the nuclear power plant. We've perfected it. If we can get the new National Energy Regulatory Commission out of the way in terms of delaying production, we can build more nuclear power plants, which are the ultimate green energy. So in terms of energy, we really do have it all. And when people say do it all, you really should, and let the market dictate what works. But we have a tremendous advantage in clean energy in the U.S. that no other country has.
Is this an opportunity? You know, you've said this many times, let the market dictate where this goes. I mean, obviously, the curiosity of the federal government is hard to corral, right? I mean, they always want to get in to everything.
They do, but the problem, Newell, is they don't get into the things they should get into. And by that, I say a national grid. You know, that's one advantage China has. When President Xi dictates something, it happens. And I certainly don't want a dictator in America, but we should, as a U.S. Congress, pass a bill and say, look, we're going to have an interconnected grid from east to west, north to south. We're not going to do extended environmental reviews because we have been building electric grids for 100 years. We know what the environmental issues are, but we also know that not building it is much more dangerous. So we're going to start building it this year. We're going to finish it in 3 years. So when the East Coast has surplus wind, they can ship it east and south. When the West Coast has it, same thing. Right now, we end up with surplus power from green energy that we can't be used. And that's something the federal government could do, which is build a national grid. And, you know, I wish that President Biden had done that, because then he would have had something really strong to show for it for the green initiative, instead of, you know, just the delays that we've been focused on. But if we would do that, it would really help energy resilience and help America go forward.
I'm glad you pointed that out, but the things that they shouldn't get involved in, you know, the propensity to do so is so intense. And I was just kind of curious whether or not that propensity is diminished somewhat by the amount of the public debt that you and I have talked about. You know, I was doing some research again over the weekend about things that you have said about the public debt, you know, being, I think by 2034, the GDP ratio would exceed 120%. Those are astronomical numbers, right?
They are, and the problem with those numbers is that the public debt is something that ultimately has to be repaid. You also have to pay interest on it. And that interest is what causes our long-term rates to go up. And, you know, people will say, well, it's only 120% of GDP, and we had that at the end of World War II. But the difference is, when World War II ended, we quit spending. I mean, we dramatically quit spending because, obviously, we didn't need to keep building tanks and battleships and airplanes. And we had millions of people that came back from overseas that went to work that were involved in the Army, Air Force, and Navy. And we got to rebuild the rest of the world because, you know, there was a world war, but the only civilian casualties in America were from one bomb that the Japanese floated over across the Pacific. Other than that, our civilian infrastructure wasn't touched during World War II, not on the mainland. Obviously, it wasn't in Hawaii, but mainland infrastructure was never touched except for that one bomb and a couple of U-boats that shelled things. So we had an intact industrial base. We had a world to rebuild. We had workers that came back, and then spending dropped. Well, now we don't have a world to rebuild. We don't have workers coming back, and there's no indication yet that spending will drop. So that is definitely a problem, and it's something we're going to have to deal with because we can't keep going at this rate. Unsustainable trends are unsustainable, and it means it ends at some point. Either you gradually fix it or you have to fix it when a crisis occurs.
Let's continue this conversation. When we come back, we're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Stay with us.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Imagine uncovering the secrets that others missed. A hidden clue, a silent witness, a twist that changes everything. I'm Carter Roy, host of Murder True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast. Join me every Tuesday as we dive into a famous solved or unsolved murder case. Follow and listen to Murder True Crime Stories, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios. Available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. Just a reminder, the world's largest turkey fry put on by the Kiwanis, Don Buster's Kiwanis Club in Metairie. Just a couple of dozen turkeys left. So give them a call, 504-867-8400, or you can visit www.donbusters.org. Let's get those last orders in. Let's get those turkeys sold out today. We are visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, as it relates to the economy, you're thankful for a number of other things. Tell us about it.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. When you go down the list, you start with productivity. We're more productive than any other country. Our economy is growing faster than any other country. We're energy independent. Didn't even talk about demographics. It's unfortunate when you get to the point where you're kind of economy is shrinking because you're losing people. Most of the European Union is that situation. Russia is definitely in that situation. China is in that situation because of their horrible one-child policy. The U.S. is still growing. Now, a lot of that is because of immigration, and we do need and want immigrants, but we're an attractive place that gets people from around the world. The best and brightest from all around the world want to come here. And that makes all the difference in the world. So Our average age is 38. It's 44 in the European Union, 39.6 in China, and rising rapidly. So China's already reached peak growth and is declining in size. So demographics favor the U.S. The attractiveness to immigrants is a big, big deal, and that continues to be a very positive thing for us. So we've got a younger workforce, a more diverse workforce, and we get the benefit of that creativity. You know, it's sort of like the gumbo. It wouldn't be good if you only had one ingredient. You get all the ingredients in, you suddenly have a wonderful, wonderful dish. Well, that's the U.S. economy. The other thing people forget about sometimes is just the incredible dynamism and creativity of our entrepreneurs. You know, Forbes puts out a list of the richest Americans. They started doing it in 1982, and the top guy in 1982 is a guy named Daniel Ludwig that probably nobody remembers unless you're in the shipping business. He was worth $2 billion. He was followed by a number of people who had inherited their money, the Gettys, the Rockefellers, the Hunts. The richest people in America today, now remember, 82 when it started, $2 billion. Elon Musk, $250 billion. Jeff Bezos, $160 billion. Larry Ellison, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Steve Ballmer, and Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg's the poor guy on that list, only $94 billion. You feel sorry for him.
Well,
every one of those guys, yeah, isn't that something? Every one of those guys made their own money. None of them are inherited money. So that's the difference between our economy and the European economy. You know, if you look back at the top companies, we have a lot of churn at the top. Europe, you might have one company change out of their top companies in a decade. We've got all these brand new companies, brand new net worth, and that really makes a big difference. It gives us a much more dynamic economy. And I mean, you can say a lot of things about Elon Musk. I would recommend reading his biography. Some people think he's an alien, but he launched more spaceships last year than every other country in the world put together. He also dug holes under the ground with his boring company. He also launched a satellite network that allowed Ukraine to communicate during the war. You know, he's not to mention creating the first global EV company. So we have people, and he came from South Africa. So an immigrant came to America, made good. And these are the things that make the American economy the envy of the world. And that's one of the reasons the U.S. dollar is so strong, and it's wonderful for us when we travel. You know, in the old days, you used to always feel like you had to convert currency. A lot of our customers now just bring dollars because they're accepted almost everywhere you go.
Well, and it's quite frankly why we have the immigration challenge that we have, because everybody wants to come to this country. And
this is one of those things. I hope that we'll get it solved, because we have a lot of really bright, good people that would like to be here. We just need to go back you know, like an Ellis Island system. I went through Ellis Island. If you haven't been to that museum, it's worth it. Because on my mom's side, they immigrated through Ellis Island. And so it was so nice to see, you know, sort of walk the steps the immigrants walked. And you know, that's one of the things that makes America what it is. So when we get that in control and get, you know, more positive immigration, I think that'll be wonderful for us.
No doubt, for sure. One of the things that when we talk about the U.S. dollar and, you know, you've talked about a lot of these things. But one of the challenges, you know, going back to debt, right? And you said something, and it kind of struck me, because I always forget that the long-term debt is what's impacted, right, by this debt structure that we have. I think that's what you said.
The Fed controls the short-term rate. The market controls the long-term rate.
And that has actually just sent the commercial property sector of this country into a tailspin. Right. How do we come out of that?
Well, we we need a plan to reduce debt as a percent of GDP. And it's not, it doesn't have to be incredibly painful. I mean, one of the ways that we could do it is to say, all right, we're spending this amount of dollars. We're not going to spend more next year. We're going to spend the same amount. So as inflation goes on, as the economy grows, the debt will shrink as a percent of GDP. But we do need to get the spending under control, because we're now in a growing economy. You don't need to have deficit spending. You know, the classic Keynesian economist that most of the people on the left subscribe to said that in a growing economy, the government should run a surplus, not a deficit. What people heard was, when the economy is not doing well, the government should spend more and run a deficit. They only heard that part. It's like, okay, let's eat the ice cream, but when your weight goes up, you need to stop. And we're at the we need to stop point right now, because the Fed cannot control the long-term rate. And the big advantage of having the U.S. dollar be the reserve currency is something we never want to lose, because that really is important to us.
I was reading an article the other day, Guy, and it brought up something. You and I have talked about it in the past, but we haven't recently, that one of the other byproducts of this are the mark-to-market losses on these bond portfolios as well.
Yeah, a number of institutions, and that's what caused the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. And it's sort of baffling to me, because Silicon Valley was one of the most entrepreneurial banks, had some of the smartest people in the world. But when they received a lot of incoming money, a lot of PPP money, a lot of IPO money, they bought long-term government debt at really low rates. And they thought that they would always grow. They thought that they could always go to the market for capital. And one day they said, you know what, we're looking at our portfolio, and if we sold our portfolio, we would have a negative net worth. We would lose more than the entire net worth of the bank times two. And they said, well, we'll sell a little bit and we'll raise some stock. Well, the market looked at that and said, you guys are in trouble. And because they were in Silicon Valley, because they were in a tech area, the rumor mill started instantly through all the different online channels like Slack and Microsoft Teams, and people started pulling the money out, and you literally had a modern bank run, but it was an instantaneous run. You didn't have to go to the bank and get your money. You didn't have lines outdoors, an electronic bank run, because of their mark-to-market losses. And it really was a challenge for them. And that's the predominant reason why that bank failed. It wasn't credit losses. It was making very bad investment decisions.
So when we talk, and I guess I want to bring this back, because one of the motivating issues relative to some of these articles that I've been reading are that, we're talking about proposed tax cuts and how we're going to ultimately end up financing those. This is kind of a slippery slope, right? A very delicate balancing act.
It is. There's some tax cuts that are economically efficient, and I know they're not popular, but corporate tax cuts are very effective at stimulating growth, because companies don't actually pay the tax themselves. They pass it on to either their workers in terms of smaller pay increases, their customers in terms of higher prices, are their shareholders in terms of lower returns. But they're really a pass-through entity. So you think you're getting the money from McDonald's, they're actually increasing the price of the Happy Meal. So when you reduce taxes, you actually attract capital. And when the first corporate tax cuts occurred almost 7 years ago, Apple said, we're going to repatriate money and reinvest it in the U.S. that they've been keeping overseas. And so I think that tax cut can make sense. Some of the others don't have the same economic effect, but a corporate tax cut would actually be productive for the economy and ultimately would result in more revenue, because you'd have a faster growing economy.
All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. When we come back, we'll talk about the Russian war economy and what that means to us. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, the Russian war in Ukraine, it's changing every day. The complexity is increasing. But you talk about a war economy around this particular conflict.
Yeah, the war, and it is a war. The Russians call it a special military operation, but they invaded a sovereign country. This has been going on for 1,000 days. And what's happened is Russia never expected it to last this long. They were already bleeding people. Bright Russians were leaving. Now Russians are being killed, and they're having to pay large draft supplements to get people, typically from the poorer regions, to come fight this war. So they're pumping money into the economy in terms of bonuses to sign up for the war. They're spending a ton of money building missiles and other things that the Ukrainians are destroying pretty much as fast as they make it. And the result is prices for normal goods, you know, the butter, the sugar, wheat, flour, are skyrocketing. Retailers are having to increase security because shoplifting has gone up. Mortgage rates are high. And realtors have said the market is dead. People are afraid to invest because they're very, very nervous about the future. And the challenge is consumers hate inflation. I mean, we saw that in the U.S. I mean, it destroys your purchasing power. If you're on a fixed income, your standard of living goes down. So Russia is facing a real economic challenge. And Putin, because he's a strong man and a thug, has a hard time admitting that he's made a mistake. So right now they're pushing as hard as they can, spending as much as they can, but there's an awful lot of internal economic pressure that's pushed interest rates up, real estate sales down, and inflation up to really record levels.
Where does and this is a crazy question, but your thoughts of where does this end? I mean, obviously you have a new administration coming in. There's going to be a little bit of a different outlook as to how far we go, meaning the U.S. Where do you think this goes in the next 90, 120 days?
Where I hope it goes is the Russian economy is really it's like a house eaten up by termites. I think if we push it over a bit, pressure China to quit supplying so much to Russia, pressure the Europeans to quit evading the sanctions, really pressure the Americans that are sending things to Russia anyway, and allow the Ukrainians to defend themselves. Say, look, if it's fair for Russia to bomb a power plant in Kyiv, it's fair for you to bomb power plants in Russia. That's not an escalation. That's just even. And you need to make it more painful to continue than to stop. And until that happens, it's hard for Putin to stop. And I would really be very reluctant to believe any sort of negotiated deal unless we substantially rearm Ukraine so that they can defend themselves going forward. So I'm hoping we'll push the rotten house over. I think that would really help with the international rule of law, and it would make the countries like Iran and China that are sort of looking around and saying, well, what happens if you invade a sovereign country? Can you get away with it? And if you can, then maybe there's some sovereign countries we'd like to invade ourselves.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see as this new administration comes in, for sure. Guy, as always, thank you for your time, your insight, and we wish you and your family a happy Thanksgiving and have a great holiday season.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I can testify to those Dawnbuster turkeys. I had one last year, and they're very good. So buy those up.
We'll go buy some more. We're looking to sell them out. Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. If you want to win tickets to the next Saints home game versus the Los Angeles Sunday in the Caesars Superdome, score two premium tickets to the game, plus a pair of VIP tailgate passes from Bullseye Event Group, open bar with premium liquor, all-you-can-eat buffet from celebrity chef Aaron May, all overlooking Champions Square. It's easy to win. Go to WWL.com/contest and enter for your chance to win tickets to the Saints when they battle L.A. from Dudley DeBosier, official injury lawyers of the Saints and Saints Radio, WWL. Coming up next is Scoot on a Manic Monday, and he joins us. What's going on, Scoot?
Well, we're going to talk about two movies I saw over the weekend. I saw Gladiator 2, and I saw Wicked. And I'll talk about both of those movies, and I'll be careful, no spoiler alert needed, because I'm not going to reveal anything about the, you know, the movie that you probably don't know. I'll never forget one time I was talking about some movie about some historical event, and I mean, it was about history, and somebody said, well, you know, somebody texted him, well, thanks for spoiling it. Dude, it was like history. I mean, it's like, you know, yes, Lincoln was assassinated. He dies in the end of the movie, okay? But it's like if
surprise,
you
surprise, surprise, surprise.
No, if you don't know history, that's not on me. All right.
Hey, so, were you surprised that Wicked was only part one?
Yeah, I was, because it was 2 hours and 40 minutes of part one, and it seemed like they could tell the whole story in 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Exactly. Scoot's up next with a great lineup. Stay tuned, folks. Have a great evening.